Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 2:07 p.m. That is Central Time, and today is Friday, and it is February 26th. So today is the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought we'd kick off with precious metals because gold has pulled back by $42 and is at a new reaction low. So this correction remains ongoing, and the move below the 200-day moving average continues to be extended. So I think a lot of investors are probably going to be thinking about what on earth is going on and how can the price be going down when there are so many worries out there about inflation, about the outlook for interest rates, about the move that we've had in government bond yields, and why is gold going down today when bond yields had surged so much earlier this week? And I think that there are short, medium, and longer term consequences, and it's probably worth considering each in isolation and then trying to put them all together. So in the short term, when we think about what is happening in gold, well, there was certainly a lot of buying as a safe haven resort from March through to August, and we saw the price go from about $1,450 up to an all-time high of about 2050. So it was a pretty substantial advance. Now, there were lots of other asset classes that put in even more impressive advances. But of course, gold is a large global asset, and it requires a lot more money to move an asset like the size of gold compared to something like GameStop or Bitcoin. Then with markets starting to improve again, we started to see that demand for safe havens started to wane, and we've seen government bond yields starting to rise again. And government bond yields, they generally started rising around August. So if we're really thinking about what's the primary reason why we've seen this correction in gold, it's primarily because of rising government bond yields. So less demand for safe havens, less demand for somewhere to store cash, and against a background where the global economy is in recovering. So that's basically where we are in the short term. Now, we've had a meaningful move higher in government bond yields in here today. Now, the big question, or excuse me, this week, and yields started to pull back a little in here today. Now, the big question for a lot of investors will be whether this is a sufficiently large dip to represent a buying opportunity in government bonds. And we may in fact be there. There's a yield of 1.45-ish and change, or just a little less than that, available right now, and that is considerably higher than anything you're going to get in Europe or Japan. So potentially investors will start to think about the scope for dip buying. They've also been conditioned over the space of a 40-year bull market to give some credence to the view that buying the dips works. And buying the dip always works in a bull market. Now, the yield got all the way up to the 1.5% level. That's the upper side of the overhead trading range, and it's a natural area where we might anticipate some resistance to come through. So there was a little evidence of that coming through in here today. And investors will buy bonds, provided they think that two important characteristics have been fulfilled. The first one is that they can capture a yield that isn't going to be immediately eaten up by inflation. So that's one of the reasons why yields started to move higher. But the other reason that people buy bonds is because the Fed has got their back, or any central bank is willing to backstop the market. That's the additional reason why bond yields have been pushing higher over the course of the last few weeks, because there have been, I think, legitimate questions about whether the Federal Reserve does in fact have the bond markets back, and will they sufficiently amp up their appetite for new purchases of bonds, not just continuing with the current program, but increasing that program in order to really ensure that there's a floor under the market. Well, what we're starting to see also is inflationary pressures, and there's fear about inflation. Obviously, that's most acute in the bond market. Now, the Federal Reserve said in here this week they're not worried about asset prices. They're not worried about inflation. They're not going to jump at shadows. The rest of the world, though, is worried about inflation. Now, of course, it is worth reminding ourselves that back in May of last year, everybody was worried about global deflation and that the global economy was going to slip back into a depression. Fast forward about 8 or 9 months, and everyone is worried about the beginning of a new inflationary cycle. The last time we had this fear about an inflationary cycle was back in 2017 and 18, when people were thinking and looking at this base formation that had been forming in the 10-year Treasury yield over the preceding 7 or 8 years, and then the pop above the 3% level, and it looked like it was the beginning of a new inflationary cycle for about the space of 2 months, and then we had this epic rally in government bond prices and a huge compression in yields. The important point here is that we may be at the beginning of an inflationary cycle. It's logical that we are, because central banks all over the world have decided that they're going to do whatever it takes to get inflation. They have been attempting to create an inflationary environment for most of the last decade, and they haven't been especially effective. They've done really well with asset prices because asset prices have done nothing but rise over that time, but they didn't have the credit multiplier effect from banks participating. And at least in the USA, that credit multiplier effect from the banking sector is certainly starting to do better. And that's one of the reasons why banks are doing better right now. If we look at, for example, the Diversified Financials Index and think about that is brokers, it's investment banks, it's stock exchanges, they're pushing on to new all-time highs. Now, maybe we're getting some consolidation at present, but it doesn't look like anything major here. So the Diversified Financials Index has been pretty much going sideways, with the brief exception of the pop upwards in 2007-6, for really the last 20 years, and it's now pushing up and away. Now, that suggests that banks are in a pretty healthy position, and it does give us an insight into one of the medium-term considerations for gold. Because the yield curve spread continues to widen, and banks are yield curve plays because they get to borrow short-term and lend long-term. So we've had this extremely pronounced move higher in the yield curve over the course of the last 3 weeks. It's up to 130 basis points. It was also a little bit higher than that earlier on this week. We can simply zoom in and look at that. And we're starting to see a little contraction come in here today. But this is an undeniable trend, and the pace of the trend is picking up. So there's only two ways that the yield curve can rise. Either we're going to see yields at the short end of the curve collapse even further, or we're going to see yields at the long end of the curve rise even further, and potentially both. And this is, I think, one of the important things that's happening out there in the world right now. Banks are doing well because the yield curve is expanding. They're doing well because the Federal Reserve is buying or injecting $120 billion worth of bonds into the market every month. And then you have the fact that the U.S. fiscal authorities are also running epic deficits, and that trend of epic deficit expansion is unlikely to be contained during the current administration. So banks are looking at the potential that they will be able to make a better margin on their products. On top of that, you have the fact that the federal government is about to drawdown over $1 trillion worth of bonds and money from the Federal Reserve, and they're going to push it out into the economy. That's going to pass through the banks. Now, they are then going to see their leverage ratios start to be pressured. And if the banking sector and the wider economy is going to absorb that massive influx of additional cash, well, the banks are going to have to see their rules relaxed, or at least exceptions to their leverage ratios that were enacted during the pandemic extended, and they're due to expire in the middle of March. So this is a pretty pressing decision from the Federal Reserve. And the next meeting of the Federal Reserve governors is also in the middle of March. So it's increasingly likely that within the next 2 weeks, there is going to be a decision on how much liquidity to allow banks to absorb. And of course, the more money that banks have and the more profit opportunities they have from the yield curve and the ability to lend long when they can borrow at an attractive rate on the short side, well, then they'll be encouraged to lend. So we get the credit multiplier effect back into the banking sector, which is something we really haven't had since the global financial crisis. And that credit multiplier effect is something that does have the potential to get inflation moving again. Of course, there is the additional point that with this total reliance on the Federal Reserve, then the banks are increasingly becoming arms of the government. And that's also positive for the banking sector because they're effectively being backstopped by the government. That's exactly what happened with the PPP loans. And in order to get banks back into the lending market, well, they may also be afforded better lending conditions by governments. So this is quite positive for banks overall. But when we start to think then about what is going to be necessary, well, within the next few weeks, we're likely to see that a decision will have to be made on what to do with all that liquidity that's about to hit the market. If they don't do anything, then there is the risk. It's not a guarantee, but there is a risk that repo rates will go to zero, that money market funds will stop absorbing new cash, and that could send the repo rate into sharply negative territory. And it's, unfortunately, the closest parallel to something like that that we have is what happened with oil prices. If we go back and think about the conditions that arose that allowed oil to trade down to negative $40, well, it's an incredible set of circumstances. And it could, in fact, be mirrored in the repo markets at some point in March. So as we think about what's happening in gold right now is that we're getting a sell-off because of less demand for safe havens. But if we start to see pressure coming through in the repo market, well, it could depress short-term yields. And it could also have a knock-on effect of massively swelling liquidity in the market. And it could also further enhance this argument about the falling purchasing power of currencies. So if we're thinking about what could possibly be a catalyst for the end of this gold correction, well, it's not too difficult to think that that could potentially be it. Because as we think about what the inflationary ramifications are of incredible money printing, well, they don't all happen at once. And it takes time to really have evidence and to convince people that we are, in fact, back in a new inflationary cycle. I think one of the most instructive things that Jay Powell said this week was that it might take a year before they can really confirm that inflation is back, that it takes time, and it takes year-over-year price increases and to really give clear confirmation we're back in an inflationary cycle. And then when we think about everything that's happened in the last 12 months, and as we move through 2021, we're going to have some very loopy year-over-year comparisons. So And that's going to be particularly true in March and April, when we think about where oil prices were in the middle of March and where they're going to be in March of this year. Well, there's the clear potential that there could be a $100 carry. And those are just extraordinary types of comparisons. It means that there's going to be some very spiky year-over-year data. And that's going to be particularly true on the inflationary front. So the Federal Reserve is not going to raise interest rates. They're not going to adopt an inflationary bias in terms of their expectations until they have got clear and well-founded, clean data to point towards an inflationary bias. When we think about some of the inflationary factors, for example, when we think about this really quite impressive advance on Taiwan Semiconductor, and there's no question that the share is now consolidating following what has been just an epic advance, but it was fueled initially by demand for personal electronic devices, everything from laptops to Chromebooks, and more recently by the increased demand from the auto sector for chips. And of course, the chip sector hasn't been able to respond to two outsized sources of new demand in a timely manner, so the prices have started to go up. Well, it looks like there is supply elasticity meets rising demand. There's the potential that the rising price of electronics is something that could have an inflationary bias, but the reality is it's probably short-term in nature. And it's probably more a vestige of the damage done to supply chains during 2021. So one of the biggest arguments for inflation is that we're going to get a sea change in terms of how companies deal with the global supply chain. There's a lot of talk out there about resilience, but I just don't see any evidence of resilience. When we look at what's happening in the chip sector and this outsized demand from the auto sector, even though they were told by the chip companies that they need to make orders, they didn't do it because they just were not willing to err from their just-in-time business model. When we then look at the way that the market has transformed in a low interest rate environment, it means that we're less resilient in many respects because we've had such low interest rates, because low interest rates push up valuations. And when valuations are high, it means that companies have to be highly optimized in order to justify the valuation. They can't afford to have missed earnings. But if you're going to be resilient, it means you've got to have redundant supply. You've got to have redundancy in the entire system. And that costs money. And when redundant systems sit around doing nothing for years at a time, well, they get cut. And everyone talks about having much more resilience in the system during a crisis, but nobody wants to pay for it. So we're only really at the beginning of that kind of move. We don't really have a lot of evidence for increasing resilience at present. In fact, most companies are much more interested in getting back into buying back their shares than they are in investing in a lot more capacity. And that suggests that we're not going to get a more resilient economy. And therefore, there is the potential that what we're going to see is much more asset price inflation, and that this, I think, clear effort to devalue the purchasing power of currencies is going to be by far the most dominant trend over the course of the next few years, because governments have absolutely no plan for how to pay back the debts. They are going all for growth and hoping to get inflation. And in the meantime, the stock of debt continues to rise. So the only thing that's really supporting the government bond markets is the willingness of government of the central banks to in fact buy the debt. So that's obviously something that is a major component of why anyone would want to own gold. people bought gold as a safe haven, but they have been less willing to buy gold as a hedge against the potential for bonds to trend downwards, because we're still in a buy the dips mentality for the bond market. If we think about the total return on bonds, it's been trending higher for decades, and it means that people have built their entire careers on buying the dips in bonds. Well, we have definitely seen a dip, and the total return is now well below the 200-day moving average. So if there are dip buyers out there, they're definitely going to be thinking about buying the dip now. That may see yields starting to come back down. Well, one thing we can think about today is that it wasn't just gold that was weak. We had a sea of red in a large number of commodities. So we can see that there were a large number of commodities, whether it's oil, natural gas, or lumber, sugar, coffee, crude oil again, sorry, then orange juice, rough rice, copper, silver, nickel, then these have been all in significant negative territory in here today. So while it might be tempting to think about this correction in gold as the end of a bull market, it really doesn't look like more than a deep correction in terms of the secular bull market that's evolving. The pace of the decline is quite a bit slower than the pace of the advance. We had pushed on to new high ground. We're definitely getting some consolidation. It had paused around the $1,800 area, which had been the area of resistance between 2011 and 12. And we may yet see some additional consolidation. The one thing that we know about gold is that it tends to overshoot on both the upside and the downside. It's when people are completely disgusted with their long position that it usually starts to rebound. I had a question earlier on this week about why I hadn't bought copper. I'm bullish of copper over the longer term. Copper assets are generally very difficult to develop. We've had an epic advance, this just incredible move up from 200 cents all the way up to 400 cents in the space of a year for a big internationally traded commodity is a significant move. We're starting to see some pause and consolidation, and that's a long tail on the weekly candle in here this week. I think, again, this is another example of short-term versus long-term considerations. The damage done to the global supply chain because mines had to shut down, a lot of ships weren't moving, there was hiatuses at the various ports around the world, and then increasing demand because global recovery is picking up, that all contributed to this extremely violent advance over the course of the last 12 months. Now, as the global economy and the supply chain start to iron out again, and as as vaccines get rolled out globally, well, then that short-term consideration will get ironed out of the market. The longer-term consideration for copper is about electric vehicle demand, whether that is in terms of electricity generation capacity, whether that is renewable, or whether it is new transmission lines, or whether it is recharging capacity for electric vehicles, or whether it is the electric vehicles themselves. All of this represents new sources of demand for a copper. That's not just a 2021 story, it's a 2020s story. So this is a long-term demand cycle that is new. Historically, copper has been about the electricity sector in terms of its conductive capacity and wiring, but less about, and then of course in electricity transmission as well. Now it's more about transportation and electricity generation. So these are whole new sectors opening up to copper, and it's likely to be in a secular bull market for the foreseeable future. But no secular bull market moves up in a straight line. And we have to remember that we are dealing with commodities. So when they are really overextended on the upside, well, then that's generally a time to take some profits off the table. And when they pull back in a violent manner, and they are quite capable of pulling back in a violent manner, well, then that is generally when it is best to step in. It's generally also not a bad strategy to have bids way below the market, because the size and the speed of pullbacks you can have in the commodity market, which are designed by traders to shake out weak holders, they can be extremely swift and violent. The other, if we're thinking about the supply demand, or the supply inelasticity meets rising demand argument, well, the rising demand argument has got legs, then the supply inelasticity argument is equally powerful, because it takes years to develop new copper resources, and there haven't been new copper supplies discovered. So there's a lot more money that has to go into finding them, developing them, building the infrastructure. If we're thinking about, for example, there's a copper mountain in the center of Congo, and getting the copper out of there will require roads, railways, and mining equipment in one of the most harsh environments in the world. So these are the kinds of long-term decisions that tend to come up at the end of the cycle. Nobody wants to talk about the difficulty of doing all of that at the beginning of the cycle, because prices haven't been going up for long enough, and nobody will give them any money to go off and do these adventurous things. The reality is that commodities have got a long history of destroying capital. And in an environment where interest rates are low and there are abundant opportunities for growth in the innovation sector, well, why would anybody then devote the billions necessary to go off and build a mine in some inhospitable place and then potentially lose it all because it's impossible to get the resources out? The only time investors are willing to throw money at the commodity sector is after an epic, just a huge move that lasts for years. And then supply all comes onto the market at the same time, and you get a triple waterfall crash, which is exactly what we saw in 2011 after a decade of investment in new supply. So we're due consolidation in copper, and it's likely to set up the next attractive buying opportunity. And I think that that is exactly what we're seeing with gold. Gold started to rally earlier. It pulled back first. It is now pulling back more. And it's leading the wider commodity sector. So gold itself is likely to also potentially bottom ahead of some of those other commodities. Silver tends to be high beta gold. And it was down over a dollar in here today. But it's still within its range overall. And that doesn't mean that it can't break downwards from the range if gold continues to remain weak, but it does suggest that we have to be at least prepared for some additional consolidation. Platinum prices have broken out of their base formation, and now we're starting to see some consolidation as well. So certainly we're definitely seeing some pause in consolidation in the wider commodity complex. Now, when we think about some of the agricultural commodities, they've been spared a lot of the volatility, but they are short-term overbought, but not nearly as overbought as copper is, for example. So coffee is right in the region of its highs for the last 2 years. There's a clear rounding characteristic over the course of the last 5 years, and generally that feeds through into a new bull market overall. Lumber prices are another commodity that have done fantastically well. There's an acute shortage of houses for sale in a number of markets because a lot of the people that would be selling are just not moving because of their fear about the coronavirus. That is likely to ebb. but there's also likely to be a lot more building. One of the easiest ways to placate a restive population is to put them in a mortgage. And it's quite likely we're going to have a lot more building and that there will be a lot more migration because people have got a taste for working from home. Obviously, there are going to be some people that it's appropriate for. It's going to be, and everyone will now have got a taste of it, so they won't have any illusions about how easy it is or how difficult it is. I think most people will eventually come to understand that you do not work from home, you live at work, and that's a well, for some people, that's something that is very accommodative. For others, it's more of a difficult choice. So it does mean, though, that people will want different kinds of houses. They'll want new houses, and they'll want those that have got not just a couple of extra bedrooms, but maybe dedicated office space as well. It means that a lot more housing is going to get built, and that's likely to create demand for housing materials. But then we can think about the fact that interest rates have gone up, that mortgage brokers I've been talking to over the course of the last 2 weeks have been warning me that it's inevitable that mortgages are going to rise, and that it's a good time to lock in whatever rate is available, because mortgages have been lagging the move up in the 10-year bond yield. Of course, the higher mortgages go, then the less affordable housing becomes. So the Federal Reserve is in an interesting position. When we think about the short end of the curve, they're obviously going to have to do something about the repo market and do something to ensure that the economy and the financial sector can absorb this massive source of new liquidity about to hit the market. Then they also have to think about what's going to happen in terms of government bond servicing costs. We've had a very meaningful move in yields. It means that governments are going to have to spend more money on servicing their debt. That money is going to have to come from somewhere, probably by issuing even more debt. There's no tolerance for significantly raising personal income taxes. There is no tolerance for cutting back on services delivered by the government, particularly health and education. That pretty much means that we are likely to see additional upward pressure on corporation taxes, because they are the only big source of additional new revenue that governments have available to them, and there are a lot fewer corporations voting than there are consumers. So we are likely to see corporate taxes starting to push back upwards, because governments really won't have much of a choice. That is something that could crimp the ability of some companies to do well. It would probably help those that don't have profits, since you only pay tax on profits. And that would also mean that the technology sector would do well. But we're just not there yet. So there's the scope, at least, that this pullback so far, it's about halfway through unwinding the overextension relative to the trend mean. There is the potential that we've seen the extent of the pullback. It could quite easily continue downwards. If it does, it's likely to represent a buying opportunity, because we're just nowhere near the potential for the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates. In fact, I think it is much more likely that they're going to double down on liquidity provision. They simply cannot afford to have the money market the money markets freeze up. Then they can't afford for the federal government to go bust either. So we're still in a quantitative easing environment. We're still in an environment where the central banks will have to provide assistance. And we've seen a rout over the last couple of days in the government bond markets. So that is something that will alert them to what the threats are. Now we can think about, for example, the kinds of companies that have got strong moats. This moat ETF, it's the Morningstar Wide Moat ETF, and one might think that it is populated by companies like Apple, but it's companies like Charles Schwab and Wiley and Wells Fargo and Cheniere Energy. These are rather different companies than one might immediately think about, but their number one characteristic is that they do tend to dominate their respective industries, and they don't have a lot of competition. So it's been a really quite impressive performer over the course of the last decade, and it has also just this week started to encounter some resistance. But it's another one of these assets that has tended to be a buy on the dips. So we're definitely due a dip. But there is the relative security in the fact that governments just don't have a choice. And central banks don't have a choice. They have to continue to supply abundant liquidity. Because the downside of not providing the liquidity represents a major challenge in terms of the ability of the economy to perform. We are very far down the rabbit hole in terms of asset price inflation, high valuations, high price to sales ratios, and acute sensitivity to any change in the global supply chain. And that's all a factor of a knock-on effect from quantitative easing. It's not all that difficult to think that we may start to, in fact, see inflation pick up. The dollar index, however, is starting to appreciate because of that higher yield. So we're starting to see some buying of the dollar, and that could potentially see it push up back towards the 200-day moving average. The last thing the USA wants is a strong currency. They've been doing more than anybody else to weaken their currency, but they're not doing as much today as they were over the course of the last 7 or 8 months. So it's also a factor in the pullback right across the commodities complex that the dollar was stronger in here today. I remain very much of the opinion that any strength we get in the dollar will be a shorting opportunity. In fact, as I look at, and we placed a bid on a house yesterday, I've been changing my pounds. I've been holding pounds, and I haven't changed any at all for the last 5 years, but I have started changing them over the course of this week. And two reasons, of course, being I'm raising cash for a down payment, and then also because we're right at the upper side of the range. So we've had a meaningful move lower in the dollar. We're due some pause in consolidation. That's likely what is now beginning. And therefore, there is the potential that we're due a rebound in the dollar. And that could potentially put or turn short-term overbought conditions in commodities into short-term oversold conditions. If the dollar rallies, then it's likely bullish for the technology sector, because growth will also then start to reacquire some investor interest. When we then think about the outlook for the emerging markets, the hedges against a weaker US dollar tend to be emerging markets, and then also the commodities sector. The wider yield curve spread is also beneficial for the banking sector and the energy sector. But if the dollar continues to rally, well, then we're likely to see some pause in consolidation coming through in the emerging markets. There are some of these indices that have done really very well. So, for example, the Nifty index has done really exceptionally well since the lows back in March. And now we're starting to see at least some consolidation. We may yet see a pullback towards the 200-day moving average. That would be a meaningful pullback from where we are right now, and it hasn't broken its sequence of higher reaction lows just yet. But it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that if the dollar does extend its rebound in the short term, then it will contribute to some pause here. As we look at the Vietnamese index, it's right in the region of the peak from back in 2018, and that's pretty close to its all-time peak as well. And it's pausing here. So we've had a reasonably large pullback and a rebound, and we might just see some additional consolidation as well. We looked at Taiwan Semiconductor, and that is pretty much a euphemism for the Taiwanese market in totality. The Japanese market was down 1,200 points in here today, so it's definitely encountering resistance around the 30,000 level, and we're due at least some pause and consolidation. It's been a really impressive breakout, so we're due at least some consolidation. It could easily pull back to the region of the trend mean, find support in the region of the upper side of the base, or the upper side of that first step above the base, and then continue to move higher. As we think about the outlook for the global economy, there's a lot of enthusiasm about the reopening. And when we look at news out of the UK, where people are becoming more enthusiastic about booking foreign holidays for 2021, and then we can think about Dufry, which broke up and out of its range in here this week. So they have got a lot of leverage to duty-free shopping, and a lot of, and of course, that is completely dependent on traffic through the various airports. So the fact that it is pushing up and out of this range, that's supportive of the view that we are moving into more of a reflationary environment. Of course, in a more reflationary environment, there will be less need for outsized assistance, but we're just too close to the beginning of the reflation. We're just nowhere near where central banks will be comfortable enough to remove that accommodation. And these recoveries are really only just beginning to take place. The one thing that I think a lot of people are worried about is that there are a number of variants, whether it is the South African or the Brazilian or the UK. And I read this week that California now has its own variant. And then there are panicky kinds of prognostications that what happens if somebody contracts both the UK and California versions and breed a super mutant version of the coronavirus? In fact, I would think that something like that is more likely than not over the course of the next few years. But the reality is that vaccines have been developed. Now, we can have an argument, really, we could last for months in terms of the back and forth and on the argument about vaccines versus treatment and prevention. But the reality is that one thing that is clear, we're in a highly optimized global economy, and a lot of people look on the global supply chain and the optimization that we've had in terms of every parts of our lives, and people just don't want to have the risk of getting knocked out for only 2 or 3 weeks of illness and recovery. They would much prefer to get a shot and not have to deal with any of that. So that was the clear decision made by the US administration to pioneer vaccines and to really push for the vaccine option. If we think about what they did in Sweden instead, was simply to let it run through and to allow herd immunity to evolve. One thing that we can think of is that both of those strategies have worked, and the number of cases continues to contract. Then we can think about what the risk represented by those variants is. Are they really going to be more deadly? Just how transmissible they are is obviously going to have an impact on how many people get sick quickly, but are they more deadly? And then, of course, having proved the efficacy of a vaccine, altering the vaccine for a booster shot, and increasing familiarity with the pathogen, that just means that we're going to have even faster new iterations of vaccines. It's quite likely that we're moving more into a kind of environment that we have with the seasonal flu. Obviously, the coronavirus is a very bad type of flu, but the response to it is probably going to be quite similar. So that by the end of 2021, then we're likely to be looking at the real potential that the ability of the global economy to adjust around the threat from this coronavirus and all of its mutants is likely to be fully adjusted. And there will be vaccines available for absolutely anyone who wants them. So we're likely to have a much bigger recovery. The one thing that I find just really particularly interesting is, having gotten out of California for the first time in nearly a year, the attitude and just the way of dealing with the pandemic in Dallas is just so much more different. The fact that they have really been able to get their numbers under control, because at least half the population is social distancing, but that they have not closed the schools, that they have been really quite diligent in keeping the social distancing inside the restaurants quite disciplined. And it means that people have not had to lose their jobs, that people tend to look to be really a lot happier. When I contrast that with the fact that California has had this lockdown on and off for a year, lots of restaurants have gone bust, millions of people have been put out of work. Then they decided that half of workers were essential employees, but the reality is that cases in California surged even though they had lockdowns, for the simple reason that a lot of the people that they designated as emergency or as essential workers were among the poorest people, living in very tight quarters and providing services and basic services to any number of businesses. They were the people that spread it around, and nobody really paid any attention to that fact that the poorest people live in very cramped conditions, and that they also provide a lot of the basic services upon which the entire city relies. So the half measures of lockdowns and then not lockdowns and one living beside the other was completely ineffectual. And I think these are some of the factors that are beginning to come to light. But the reality is that as people come out from their abodes and become more active, then it's very easy to slip back into your normal lifestyle. I think we've eaten out every day for the last 2 weeks, and we've been enjoying ourselves to an incredible extent, and perhaps more so than, or at least we're enjoying a vacation more than we have in years. So I think these are some of the factors that are probably going to continue to drive this reflation. And I know that it was Ian Little who made the comparison with the restoration period after the restoration of Charles II. That was when ostentatiousness really took off in the UK. And I guess then we can think about some of the idiosyncrasies of the current environment. GameStop, for example, popped on the upside for 2 days and came back down again. I tend to think of these types of moves in companies that really have no good business doing well as something like the charge of the light brigade, and that investors in these types of companies will eventually be completely slaughtered, because companies like this just don't seem to have the wherewithal to adjust and prosper in the growing technological environment. As we think about the pace of technological innovation, artificial intelligence continues to accelerate, And the ability to optimize and the huge amount of data that is being produced, it means that the economy will be running more efficiently, but probably less or in a less resilient manner for the foreseeable future. And I think that is something that we've all come to, I think, appreciate as technology has been rolled out, because technology makes things easier and on the one hand and more difficult on the other. I've had a lot of difficulties, for example, over the course of this couple of weeks with the audio on in the podcast, but not on the video, because for whatever reason, my legacy version of the software for recording my audios, which we both David and I used for over 20 years, just started picking up other microphones that I don't even have. And again, this is a piece of technology that has been reliable for years and then suddenly stopped working. When we think about all of the different factors where we can look at how technology has made our lives easier, has allowed us to be more productive, but then also makes things more difficult. Well, that is probably exactly what we can continue to expect, that there will be clear innovations, but that they will require more of our time. That time is by far the most precious of all commodities. And when we then think about what the demands are likely to be in terms of the global environment, the competition for returns, the drive to capture yields, and the lowering purchasing power of currencies is going to create more of a competitive environment. And eventually that will translate into an inflationary environment because this is not like any other cycle we've had before. Central banks now, I think, understand that they need to get inflation back, and they need to do something to deal with the massive quantity of debt. And that means that they are going to leave interest rates alone for a prolonged period, and eventually that will contribute to inflation. It means that asset prices are likely to continue to be buys on the dip, that eventually we're going to see this evidence of clear intervention and yield curve control, and that will then be responsible for the next leg down in the dollar, the next leg upwards in gold and commodities. But in the very short term, it's likely the dollar will first rally and that the commodity complex will probably ease back a bit further first. That may also take a tax on the performance of emerging markets and on stock markets more generally. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.